The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This evening, I want to now continue with a series that I started last week, and that is this series on emotions. Last week, I gave a kind of general introduction to the topic of emotions. That's something we address and look at in Buddhist practice. And to support that endeavor, and then starting tonight, and then in a series of Mondays from here, I'm going to pick up particular emotions and give and talk about them, explore particular ones. And today, I'm going to explore fear. Seems like a good one. There was, it seems like among popular Dharma talks, many years ago, they don't really have it anymore, but they had a service where they sold back then was cassette tapes of Dharma talks, an organization called Dharma Seed. And about 15 years ago, I asked them for the list of their top 10 selling Dharma talks. So I got the list from them. And what was interesting was, of the top 10 best-selling Dharma talks of 1995, back then, the top ten, four of them had to do with fear, indicating that it was something of major concern for people. And then here at IMC, a number of times we've done a series of classes on mindfulness and depression. And a couple of years ago, after doing one of these, someone came to me and said, "Gil, that's fine for you to do mindfulness and depression here at IMC, but you have to realize that As big an issue as depression is in our culture, anxiety is as big. And it's a really big, and you should do a series on anxiety." So at least we'll do a day tonight, evening, on fear, anxiety, dread, angst, panic, fright, alarm. What else? Is that enough? What?
Loathing.
Fear and loathing. You have to save your loathing for the talk on anger. So when a person would come to the monastery to come and try to join as a monk or a nun, the abbot would always have an interview to see if they were suited for the monastic life, suited to really take them practice seriously. And some people would be accepted in, but some people would not. They said, "I'm sorry, this is not for you." And whenever someone came to the monastery to enter the monastery and to request entry, and if in that interview it turned out that the person had no fear, the abbot would not let them join. What do you think of that? So that's for you to reflect a little bit about. Why is it that without fear, they would not be allowed to join? So fear is a very key emotion that people feel. It's a key response to what goes on around us. And there are a whole series of different categories of fear, as I mentioned just now. A big one is anxiety. And anxiety is often differentiated with fear, because fear, is not a hard differentiation, but fear is sometimes taken to be worry, concern, something of fear around something that's particularly dangerous, something particular thing that happens that we can see, we can recognize, and we're afraid of that thing. The anxiety is often said to be generalized agitation, worry, concern, fear, over something which is much more vague, something that's anticipated into the future, something that's not so clear. It doesn't have a clear threat. It often has to do with acts of imagination. It's much more vague what's going on. But even with fear, One of the very interesting issues around fear is what is it that's being threatened? What is being threatened? Rather than looking at what you're afraid of, what you're anxious of, you can ask, what is it that feels threatened? You get a very different answer. You get a very different approach to fear if you turn inward and to see what is it that's actually being threatened. And you might get very different answers. And you might have a very different response to what you're afraid of if you can really discover what is it that's being threatened. Now, in Buddhism, there's a differentiation between healthy fear and unhealthy fear. A little bit, that's a clue to that story about the abbot. All fear is not lumped together in the same category. All fear is not treated the same way as if it's bad or wrong or unhealthy. There is healthy fear. And there's one kind of fear, which is the fear of ethical transgressions, the fear of causing harm. And that fear can involve fear of causing harm for someone else, and it could also involve fear of causing harm to yourself. So the fear of making a transgression, the fear of lying to someone or stealing to someone, that fear is often considered healthy if what's being threatened is your own positive regard, your own sense of integrity, your own sense of self-worth in some way. And in Buddhism, that kind of fear of wrongdoing is called the guardian of the world. It protects the world. It's kind of a healthy thing. So if it should happen that a person would occur to someone to steal something, or to lie something, or manipulate someone in a bad way, if that thought arose, that motivation arose, and the person had no feeling, something of fear or concern about that, so no kind of healthy kind of pulling back from that and saying, no, I'm not going to go there, then they're not protected from that, and they're much more likely to go ahead and act on that. What's being threatened in that situation is hopefully something beautiful inside of ourselves, some sense of integrity. The Buddha, it was said, was a warrior. Was raised to be a warrior in the warrior caste. And there's in the ancient kind of noble tradition of being a warrior has a certain kind of high self-regard, certain kind of inner dignity. Reputation is very important for the classic kind of warrior tradition. And you wouldn't do anything in the kind of warrior that you would kind of demean yourself or that would kind of somehow undermine a high sense of integrity. So in that sense, to do something wrong, to violate the precepts or to cause harm, would threaten that sense of inner integrity. So here, someone who has some sense of that there's important quality of heart, quality of mind, quality of inner life that's being safeguarded and maintained, could easily feel that that's threatened and they want to safeguard it. And what I've seen in people who do a lot of Buddhist practice or meditation practice is that they discover or they awaken or they develop inside of themselves a sense of inner integrity, beauty, value that becomes something to safeguard. And until someone becomes completely liberated, that inner integrity can be threatened by some of the other impulses that arise from in us. And so to feel certain impulses arise, certain desires and motivations arise, saying, I don't want to go there. To feel, for example, the arising of anger and the wanting to express that anger by yelling at someone and say, I don't want to go there, not because some abstract idea of ethics, but rather I want to go there because it would violate or harm something that I know that's quite beautiful inside of myself here. And also I don't want to do it because I don't want to harm the other person. There's something beautiful about being a protector of the well-being of others, even if they've been a jerk. So there's a to come up against the possibility of transgressing in this way, one of the things we're protected by is fear, a healthy fear, that perhaps is no different than the fear that arises if you can put your hand close to a fire, you pull it back, so you don't burn yourself. That's a healthy fear to pull back. There's also unhealthy fear. And unhealthy fear can have a great cost. It's quite, and it's interesting to go through the cost or that fear has. Some people live quite limited lives because of their fear. They don't venture forth. They don't do things because of their fear of failing or fear of making a fool of themselves or fear of succeeding, whatever it might be. There's some people live isolated lives because of their fear. They hold back from connecting to other people or talking to people, making friends or new friends. There's fear. Fear in an unhealthy way can motivate us to sometimes can motivate us to lie or to manipulate or to do things which later we would regret. There's a whole series of things that fear can motivate us to do, which has a negative cost in our lives. And unfortunately, it's all too pervasive, the unhealthy fear in people's lives. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's often been said that modern Western culture, fears is much greater. The pervasiveness of fear is greater than it has ever been in human history. We live in the age of anxiety, they say. And here last week we had the H1N1 panic. And there was something about that flu virus that made people quite anxious. And perhaps there was reasons to be careful, reasons to be concerned. But you don't have to analyze very much or look very much to realize how quickly a society, people in society, get aroused to fear by what the media says, what politicians say. And in fact, stimulating fear in society is used as a political strategy because you can get people to change their minds and understand new things and go in different directions if you get them afraid. So it's well worth kind of taking some care and looking at fear and how it operates. People who are statisticians looks at risk analysis, point out how oftentimes, or often enough, people can be afraid of things that are at a very low risk that it happening. And they cannot be afraid of things which are much more risk, more likely to happen. So the fear of flying. They say that you're much more likely to be killed in a car than you are flying. But people tend to be much more afraid of flying than they are driving cars. Not always, but sometimes. Or the fear of I read once that the chances of dying in a terrorist attack is lower than being struck by lightning, at least here in the United States. And I know that there are people who, after 9/11, would scan the sky every time they heard a plane. It makes some sense after this kind of big shock of 9/11 to have that kind of fear. But statistically, the chances that the plane flying above you was going to be, a bomb was not so likely. The way that the human mind evaluates what's risky, what's worthy of fear, is not always reliable. So it warrants us to look more carefully at fear. And this is, I think, the call of Buddhist practice. And what Buddhist practice has to offer in this regard, Buddhist practice is not afraid of fear. Buddhist practice encourages us to stop and look at fear. And looking at fear changes the fear. I read recently that a study a report about a study about how the amygdala gets activated with fear. I guess it's a fear center. What?
Amygdala.
It's a fear center. And that when the part of the brain that is used to observe, to watch what's going on, watches fear, the amygdala calms down. In other words, the very act of looking at fear and watching it can change the fear and settles it, calms it a little bit. Doesn't make it go away, but makes it less active. But how is it that we can look at fear so that it becomes less threatening, less active, rather than spinning out? Because certainly panic attacks sometimes happen when we're afraid of something. We notice we're afraid, and it stimulates more fear, and then it becomes a cycle. We spin out more and more. So part of what we do in Buddhist practice is to learn how to look, how to notice. And then we learn to use our capacity to notice to look more carefully at what's going on. So we learn to look at fear, and we learn to look at it in a healthy way, and we learn to look at it carefully so we can learn from the fear. And I think it's useful to take emotions, all emotions, but emotions like fear, and think of it as a messenger rather than thinking of it as a mistake. And even if we can differentiate between healthy fear and unhealthy fear, even if it's unhealthy fear, I think it's helpful to take it as a messenger that is calling on us to pay attention to something more carefully. We're being asked to look more carefully. What is this fear? And because it says something. It says either something about the world, that there's some danger out there that we need to address, or it says something about us. That there's something within us that needs to be addressed and looked at. Either way, if fear has arisen, both areas can be very, very helpful to look at. If fear has arisen, something important needs to be looked at. If it's the mountain lion about to attack, that's useful to know. If it's a real fear, real something to be afraid of. But if it's anxiety about feeling uncomfortable, if you're afraid of feeling uncomfortable, or you're afraid about what people will think about you, or if you're afraid about public speaking, or you're afraid about it's a whole series of fears, fear of spiders, afraid of heights, afraid of driving. It might be more productive to turn within and look at that fear and learn about yourself than it is to learn about the details of spiders. So the point I'm trying to make here is that in Buddhist practice, we take these emotions like fear as a call to bring more careful attention to them. And that's different than how most people, I think, relate to fear. Because often people are afraid of fear, either afraid of fear and they pull away, or they react out of the fear without really understanding the fear or looking at it. So they act in unhealthy ways. So we stop to look at it. Now, how we look at it is important. And one of the encouragements that Buddhism gives is we try to look at it as without defining ourselves by the fear. So have a fear. If we notice a fear is there, and we try to recognize it as fear with respect. Oh, here's fear. But without saying, I am a fearful person. I am afraid. And the difference is that when there's fear and we add the element, this is who I am, we tend to get much more entangled in it, much more caught up in the fear. It becomes much more real. It becomes much more difficult to see clearly what it is. So we try in Buddhism to see the fear respectfully, but not to take it personally. Not to say, oh, this is who I am. That allows us, in a sense, to step back from the fear and really see what it is. If you are the fear, how can you step back? It'll just go with you. So it's not when fear arises, it's not all of who you are. It's part of who you are. It might be very important. So how can you step back to see it for what it is? Sometimes people can do it by just arousing stronger mindfulness and seeing it, and naming it. Oh, here's fear. And sometimes people, you have to change kind of how you're aware. Some people find it helpful to step back in their mind's eye, so they kind of look at the fear from a distance. Like, be as far away from it as you can be without being caught up in it. So that act of imagination, they can step back and back and back. Like, imagine that you're sitting in the chair behind you and looking at someone who's afraid. Or imagine that your awareness is as big as the room that you're in, or as big as the house you're in, or as big as the state you're in. How big do you have to make your awareness so you're not so caught by it? So the fear is there, not being denied, but it's not kind of grabbing you or pushing you around or holding you, or you're not reacting to it. Some people, when they hear the instructions to be mindful of fear, think that they're supposed to go right up into it and be attentive to it. And sometimes it's better not to get too close to it. Just ride the edges of it. And one way to ride the edges of fear is to bring mindfulness to your fear of the fear, if there is fear of the fear. And sometimes it's much more useful to hang out on the edges. Just notice how anxious you are about having fear. And it might be a lot easier to be present for the fear of the fear. It's not as big a deal. So you sit there, work with that, work through that, and if that settles away, and you're no longer afraid of your fear, then you take a step a little bit closer to the fear itself. And then you don't have the agitation of the secondary fear that makes it difficult to see. Another way that helps to feel and experience the fear respectfully, without taking it personally, is to feel the fear in your body. For some people, this is very helpful because the body is not the story of what we're afraid of. So the mind won't spin out as easily into the story if we feel the physical manifestation in the body. So that, you know, you could be sweating, you could be a lot of energy in different parts of your body, you might tense up in different places. It might be around the eyes, it might be in the shoulders, it might be in the belly, it might be in the chest, many places where they might tighten up and you feel tension connected to the fear. There might be a lot of vibrating energy some places that are going on with the fear. Drop into the body and feel the physical manifestation in the body. It's a way of grounding the attention in something that's a little more concrete and immediate. And for some people find, then it's harder for the mind to spin out in its concern. Now, if it's something that is, so then it's possible to be more present for it and see it. One of the reasons why it's important to see it respectfully, without taking it too personally, is that we can evaluate how real it is. To reflect a little bit, is what I'm afraid of here really something that's frightening? Is there really some risk here, some danger here? And what's the nature of that danger? What is being threatened? What do we think is being threatened inside of us? If it's the mountain lion, or if it's a real danger, and we see it's a real danger, then hopefully we act on that and do the appropriate thing, take care of ourselves. But what if what's being threatened is your self-image? And what if your self-image is not a useful self-image to have? It's not even the self-image you would like to have. Perhaps the self-image you have is that you want to be the smartest person on the block. So everyone knows how wonderfully smart and clever you are. And so you are invited to a dinner party of Nobel laureates. And you're afraid to go because you're going to appear stupid. So you look at that fear. Is that a fear? Now, in contrast to those Nobel laureates, perhaps you won't seem as smart. But who cares? Do you want to live your life concerned about self-image or how other people see you around something like this? Aren't there better things to do? Aren't there better things to safeguard inside yourself? Aren't there better qualities of heart and mind than concern about self-image, and concern about what other people think about you in this kind of way? What about kindness, for example? Maybe actually what these Nobel laureates really value at the party, at dinner party, is if someone would come and be kind to them. They don't care how smart you are. This is probably not, you know, wasn't a good example, but I was trying to just choose some example to point out that to look and see what is it being is being threatened. And the whole idea of self-image, how we represent ourselves to ourselves and to others, is one of the areas that's very fruitful to look at in terms of what is being threatened. And then to question it. Do I really want to live that way? Is this something that's useful? There are also people who have fear that is of nothing really happening now, but it's a leftover legacy of trauma from before. And this kind of fear we need to be extremely respectful for, because it kind of, it's almost like embedded deep down in our muscles, in our bones, in our cells, deep in our psyche. And it, as it comes up, especially when we do mindfulness practice and we're very attentive and not inhibiting things, not inhibiting or blocking the inner life, some of these earlier unfinished traumas can resurface. And so it's very, very important to be very caring and compassionate about this. And again, not take it personally as a personal failure or that it's wrong to have these things be here, but rather it's something to make space for and allow to somehow settle, to somehow unwind itself, to disentangle itself, somehow for those muscles to begin to soften around it, so those synapses to begin kind of relaxing a little bit from having, you know, firing all this time. So that's why, again, and one of the ways to do that is to hold the fear in the body. Let the body be the holder of it. Sometimes the mind is not a very useful holder for fear, but the body for some people can be much more useful. And so we drop into our body and feel the actual manifestation and expression of the fear in the body itself. And then let it kind of unwind, unfold, evolve, move through us as it needs to move through in present moment time. And the present moment time is a very important part of this how to pay attention, because sometimes with fear, it can very quickly or very easily stimulate stories and thoughts, ideas about the future, ideas about the past, that are not helpful for that respectful caring of the fear, letting it bubble up. How much of your fear is anticipatory fear? How much fear do we have, that many people have, that is not about something that's immediate, but about a projection into the future? And what happens if we really hear and see what's going on here and now? How does that change the experience of fear? So I think that one of the most, the main thing I wanted to convey in a talk about fear, mindfulness and fear, is that when we're devoted or committed to mindfulness practice, we take fear as something that's important, we respect it, and it's something we stop for in order to look at more carefully. Rather than acting on the fear or recoiling from the fear, it's something that we investigate and look at. And sometimes in all fears, whether it's mild and subtle or whether it's really big, sometimes the subtle fears are more productive to go into than some of the big fears. As we look at the fear, it's helpful to ask, at some point or other, what is it that's being threatened? Is it something that is real and important for you, valuable to protect? If it is, protect it. If it's something which is not valuable for you, or maybe it's not valuable for what is most important for you. You know, I could be afraid of losing the California lottery. Oh, I chose the wrong number. I don't even know how it works, but I guess you choose numbers, right? And, you know, that doesn't really represent something very important for me. So anyway, part of fear is to evaluate, working with fear is to evaluate what is being threatened. And is it really something that that deserves our protection? Or can we let go of something? Our egotistical sense of self. The fear of insecurity might seem like we look, oh, my sense of security is at risk. We might think, oh, it's important to protect my sense of security. It might seem that way. But actually, to hold on and cling to security is one of the sources of ongoing suffering and distress. It's fine to try to create some security, but we live in a world where security is never guaranteed. And a mature spiritual life is one that learns to be at ease with insecurity. If we cling to security, we will be afraid. So, to turn around and look, what is being threatened? And then begin questioning that, evaluating that, reflecting on that. It's a lot easier to do that if first you do the mindfulness practice of learning how to hold it, the fear, respectfully, without taking it personally. To hold it respectfully without being for it or against it. Hold it respectfully without resisting it or being afraid of it. Just to hold it, see it there for what it is. And once it's there, then it can be very interesting then to evaluate and reflect what's really going on here. The word integrity, when I looked it up in the dictionary for its etymology, it seems to mean that which cannot be touched. I was a little bit surprised when I first looked that up, because integrity seems like such a precious and wonderful thing. But, you know, like tangible, in the same kind of root, can't be touched. And after a while, I thought, this is a great word. Because what is that precious place of peace, of liberation, of love, of compassion that's within us that cannot be touched by the conditions of the world, cannot be touched by our self-definitions, cannot be touched by how other people think about us, cannot be touched by how other people treat us. To have some sense of this inner peace, inner well-being, and how well it can be there, independent of the conditions of the world, can give us a very different relationship to fear and how we evaluate it. Because we realize there's something precious here that's more precious, more valuable than what we're trying to protect. Your integrity needs no protection. It just needs you to leave it alone. Make space for it. So those are my thoughts about fear. I feel a little apologetic for having talked so long. I was afraid that would happen. Because I wanted to hear if there was any questions or concerns from you on this important topic. So we have about 5 minutes, so if maybe one or two of you have something you want to raise, I'm happy to try to respond. Yes.
I was just wondering, well, two questions. When you're going to give a talk on anger?
Will that be next week, week after?
Would
you say the same kind of application would apply with anger, stepping back from it and kind of seeing it for what it is and so forth?
I think it's very similar. Anger should be respected. Anger is it's a signal that something important is going on, and that it warrants our attention. And then we look at it and see whether the source of it, what the catalyst for it is, what's that about? Is it arising out of our ignorance and delusion, our greed, hate, and delusion, or is it arising out of something else? So yes, a little bit similar. We could stop and look at it and hold it, respect it, don't take it personally, don't be pushed around by it. So I was wondering what I'd talk about next week. I don't know whether we should alternate between so-called negative emotion and so-called positive emotions, go back and forth, so that people don't get too overwhelmed, or whether we should just do a whole series, just get into it. There's this idea that there are four primary emotions that humans have, kind of baseline emotions, basic emotions. There's anger, sadness, fear, and joy. So, if I followed those four that Paul Ekman talks about, then we can't alternate, because it's 3-1. But what should we do? Should we do anger next week, or should we do something? Yay. Yeah. But no one's saying no. I once gave a talk many years ago. I showed up in the sitting group and I said, I'm going to give a talk today about enlightenment. But before I do, is there anything that, you want to ask or say? We spent the whole evening talking about anger. People are more interested in that than they were enlightenment. Yes. You had a question, Robert? No, I thought. Yes.
When you mentioned that we could listen our body to realize where is the fear and try to understand that, how can I actually do that? Like, what kind of process we should follow to listen our body?
Uh-huh. So how we would notice in the body. A big part of mindfulness practice is the training of learning to pay attention to what goes on in our body. The feelings, the sensations, the movements, how we hold the body, how we move through space. And all those things relate back to our emotional and our motivational life, to what goes on inside of us. So it's a wonderful window to our life. And the body is such an important window that I, for myself, have reworded. I think it was Jung's saying. He said that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. And I think a better road, the royal road, the really royal road, is the body. If you really, because the body kind of opens up in a deep way. So how do you do it? You do it by starting to paying attention, noticing what goes on in your body. If you're not so much in touch with your body, some people find it helpful to start doing a systematic training to actually start looking at the body at various times in the day or in meditation. Maybe scan through the body systematically, starting at the head, the face, the neck, the shoulders, the chest, the belly, the back, the arms, the legs, and just kind of noticing what is there. And maybe at first, not much is there. It feels kind of numb or neutral or something. But just keep doing it until you start noticing that, what the sensations are there, what the tightnesses are there, what the loosenesses are there, what the energy, the agitation that might be there. And all emotions will have some kind of physical manifestation in your body. And in fact, if you had no physical manifestation to the emotion, you probably wouldn't know what emotion it was. So just a matter of turning and doing and spending time to do it. So hopefully that was an okay answer. Yes, last one. Then.
I find that if I have a very strong emotion, that I will either tend to phase out and lose track of time, or I will jump into a story. And, I'll go through the, okay, leave it alone, forget the story, concentrate on my body. And when I do that, I'll often kind of phase out after a while, and then I'll go back to a story or something. And this, it's like there are different scenes in the play that just keep going and going and going, and then the meditation's over.
So, what triggers the fading away? Just before you start fading off, what happens to you?
I think the problem is there's a lack of awareness when that happens. So for me, I think it's because I'm focusing on my body and it has played out.
If it's what?
It has, the sensations that I'm going through have dissipated. And I'm sort of settling down into a relaxing state.
The emotion then has also faded away too.
Yeah.
Oh, so then, so if it's like that, then it's a very common phenomenon in meditation that as people get calm and settled, the mind starts to drift into. And the drifting and fading away is usually pleasant at this point. Yeah. So it's usually a pleasant kind of dreamlike state that happens. And anybody who meditates for a long time sooner or later will encounter that and has to learn how to work with that. And general instruction is you have to bring up more energy, more alertness. So when you start feeling that kind of nice fading feeling, sit up straighter, maybe open your eyes, arouse more mental alertness. If you use mental noting, which is very good to use in this circumstance, start noting a little bit more often, a little bit faster perhaps, or a little bit more adamantly in the mind, just a little more energy behind it, so that you're matching the calm that you have with more energy and more alertness. And then you'll keep going. But it's your responsibility. It's very important for you as the meditator to notice the drifting mind and then compensate by bringing a little bit more alertness or energy in. Now, many people, when they meditate, associate meditation with calm and being soothed and comforted. And so if that association is too strong, some people fall into those kinds of states, and they feel like, this is right, this is good, finally. Finally. And they just kind of like bask in it and just drift off. And it's fine to bask in it for a while, but it's not meditation anymore. Okay. So I hope this was useful for some of you. And I hope that maybe for during this week that you'll pick up fear, anxiety, dread, worry, and all those things as an interesting subject of exploration. And look for opportunities during this week to, not to make yourself afraid, but but look for opportunities for when you are afraid to look at it and explore it in new ways. And if you do this, exploration and explore your fear and all this, this week, I would strongly encourage you, if you have someone you can go find, to talk to about what you've discovered. And it might be a friend, it might be a therapist, it might be better for it to be a total stranger. But to have a chance to talk to someone about this very important part of your life might actually help you in the process of kind of getting a better handle on it. So, thank you.